This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. At the Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania last night, President Bush outlined a five-part plan for Iraq.
The first of these steps will occur next month when our coalition will transfer full sovereignty to a government of Iraqi citizens who will prepare the way for national elections. On June 30th, the coalition provisional authority will cease to exist and will not be replaced. The occupation will end, and Iraqis will govern their own affairs.
President Bush speaking last night. If you'd like to hear the complete speech, you can go to our website at npr.org. With the transfer date now just 5 weeks away, the president's address last night and the introduction of a draft resolution at the UN Security Council signaled the start of a new effort to mobilize international and public support for what the president warned may be difficult days ahead. In just a moment, we'll get reaction from two U.S. senators, and we'll get analysis of the British-American proposal to the Security Council. Some of the questions center on the powers of the interim government in Iraq. While the president said full sovereignty last night, both his speech and the draft resolution make it clear that U.S.-led forces would be free to act on their own and would not be under Iraqi control. We'll also talk about the replacement of the U.S. commander in Iraq, and after federal authorities released and apologized to a man in Oregon who'd been held as a material witness, we'll talk about the use of that statute in the war on terrorism. If you have questions about the president's speech, the way ahead in Iraq, the role of the U.N., give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now on a payphone, where he's kindly stopped along the highway outside of Lansing, Michigan, is Michigan Senator Carl Levin, the top Democrat on the Senate Armed Services Committee. Good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Neil, good to be with you.
Did the president say what he needed to say last night to reassure the American public and provide leadership on the way ahead in Iraq, do you think?
Not really, because he didn't indicate where there's going to be a change in our course. We've got to correct the course. The president just kind of basically repeated what he's been saying consistently here, which is that we've set a date for the transfer of sovereignty, but he didn't really lay out any kind of a specific way in which we're going to be able to attract international support. We've got to do that. Everyone, I think, finally realizes that, even in this administration, which is done very little to attract and reach out to the international community, but there was no roadmap there for any kind of a positive, specific effort. How will we share power with the UN after June 30th? How can we make them true partners? It's not enough to simply say we want them. What are we willing to give up in terms of decision-making power so that we can attract other countries to join with us in what is not a particularly attractive endeavor?
As you look at what the president had to say and some of the reaction today, which has been relatively mixed, depending on who you talk to, the question of the definition of full sovereignty appears to be a critical one right now. Is it sovereignty if the government in a country does not have control of foreign troops on its own soil?
No, it's not full sovereignty. The president tried to end confusion in his own administration about what sovereignty would be transferred before a few days ago. Some people in the administration said limited sovereignty. Other people said full sovereignty. The president opted for the rhetoric of full sovereignty, but it's not truly full sovereignty if we're going to have control over our own troops. And I think we have to have that control, by the way. We might as well be honest about it. We're not going to allow the new Iraqi government, which is going to be very, very weak to begin with, to decide what our troops are going to be able to do to accomplish their mission.
This is a key element of the UN draft resolution. We'll be talking more about that in a few minutes later in the program. But do you think this could be a deal breaker with many of the critics of the war who also sit on the Security Council?
Well, I think what we're going to have to do is find a way to provide or present a full sovereignty, the rhetoric of full sovereignty, and the feel as much as possible of full sovereignty, but be honest about the fact that we're not putting our troops under the control of this Iraqi entity, assuming it can be created. There's just no way that that could be allowed. So we don't want to, and we can't dominate Iraq. We can't just have, for instance, an ambassador there who acts as though he's the governor of Iraq. On the other hand, we cannot put our troops at risk by saying that the Iraqi government is going to be able to command in any way what our forces do.
And one thing that has been coming up a lot lately in suggestions here in Washington and elsewhere is the idea that more American troops might be needed to stabilize the situation. A lot of people are anticipating more difficulties in the handover date and then even more difficulties in the period running up to elections next January. Were you surprised? I mean, General Avezade, didn't he testify before your panel, the Senate Armed Services Committee last week, that he needed more troops?
Well, he said he needed 130,000 troops to stay there and that he might need more troops. He didn't say he did need more troops now. The president said what a president should say, which is that if the commanders ask for more troops, we'll provide them. But really the problem is that the troops that we need there additionally are Iraqi troops, and we need other countries' troops, particularly Muslim nations, to provide some troops. And the only way we're going to get the other nations to come in is if we're willing to be really a true partner with the international community. We need that support. It's not enough to say we're going to encourage them, as the president said last night. We've got to indicate that we're going to do something new, something different, something specific to win international support.
If you'd like to join us, our number is 800-989-8255. You can also email us, TOTN@NPR.org. And let's take a call from Jim, who's with us from Waco, Texas.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Good. Listen, that speech last night, I didn't hear anything new except tearing down that prison. You know, I expected to hear something new, and there was nothing new. But I have a question here. I think this whole discussion is really begging the question of whether or not the Iraqis want a democracy. I mean, suppose they don't want a democracy. From everything I've heard with the Kurds and the Sunnis and the Shiites, they don't even get along as well as Democrats and Republicans.
Senator Levin?
We'll find that out if we can get to the point of elections. But right now, we've got to work with that international community, offer them something new, offer them a true partnership in order that we can take the next steps to get to those elections, which will decide whether or not the Iraqis want a democracy or not. But they've got to decide that for themselves. We've been much too much of a domineering, occupying power. We've got to find a way to return sovereignty to the Iraqis. But in order to get credibility for that, and the most important thing about that June 30th date is whether or not there can be a group appointed by the UN which will have the support and credibility of the Iraqi people. That is going to be the most important single test. If we can do that, then we will have taken a step towards those elections, which will decide that whether that man is right or not about whether the Iraqis want democracy.
So the important part, Senator Levin, is to hold the ring until those elections can provide a credible Iraqi government?
Yeah, and to do that, though, again, we got to change the dynamic, change the mix, and do something new. We got to change the course if we're going to get the international support in ways that will bring in particularly Muslim countries with some forces to support the effort.
Jim, thanks very much for the call.
Okay, thank you.
And Senator Levin, thanks for taking the time to speak with us today. And,
good being with you, Neil.
And good luck on your drive to Lansing.
Take care.
Senator Carl Levin of Michigan, the senior Democrat on the Senate Armed Services Committee. Joining us now is Senator Sam Brownback, a Republican from Kansas, a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And Senator Brownback, nice to speak with you again.
Neil, good to talk with you.
Did the president, do you think, offer a credible vision of the way ahead last night, one that will reassure the flagging public support?
I think he offered a continuation of the vision of the way ahead. I don't know if there's anything that's particularly new in it. Outside of, I agree with the caller that called in about the destruction of the prison. But that's also, to me, that's reassuring. We shouldn't be discovering new ways at this point in time. We ought to be implementing the plan that's in place. And the plan calls for the turning over to an Iraqi leadership that's selected primarily by the international community by June 30th, and we should be implementing this plan, moving it on forward, and that's what I saw more of the speech last night was kind of detailing mileposts along the way of the implementation and where we are and how we're making progress.
So steady on the course. Let's not get too carried away. There will be difficult days ahead, but we're on the right track.
Well, I think the best way to describe it is this is enormously difficult of what's taken place. And it's going to take a lot of time and effort, and unfortunately it's taken a lot of lives in the process. But we're moving on forward, and it will continue to be difficult. One of the things I took encouragement out of, not so much from the president's speech last night, but was a meeting of the Arab League over the weekend, where they, for the first time in my recollection, are really engaging the notions of democracy, women's rights, more open democratic societies. That's an amazing move on the part of the Arab League, who's never, in my recollection, used those sorts of words before. And I think that's all part of a result of us showing a clear commitment for these universal principles that we've stood for, but we haven't really pressed in the Arab world previously, and now we are.
Reaction in much of the Arab media around the world today has been rather negative to the what one newspaper, I think, in Qatar described as a sham sovereignty offer by the United States, that as long as U.S.-led forces are in Iraq in such numbers, free to act on their own, as the president outlined last night, that's not sovereignty.
Well, I mean, really, what would you expect from the Arab press at this point in time? It's become very stylish to beat up on the United States. This is a difficult thing that we're trying to do. The passing over of sovereignty on June 30th will be a significant move forward. I personally thought we should have passed over sovereignty much earlier, similar to what we did in Afghanistan with Karzai, where after about 2 months, Afghanistan, after the Taliban had kicked out, about 2 months later, you have an international community come together, select a leader that's not picked by the Afghan people, but has some international credibility. And that's what you're looking for. I think what will take place similarly to June 30th is this is a person selected by an international community, not by the Iraqi people, but will have some credibility that hopefully can move that nation on forward on its own sovereignty and open democratic society path.
Let's get a caller on the line. Steve's with us from Palo Alto, California.
Hi. My comment is I listened last night and I heard the president outline what needs to be done, but not how it's going to be done. And I have no faith that the planning from here on out is going to go any better than the enormously bad planning that's gone on so far.
Senator Brownback?
It seems to me that the planning, there's been phases that have been very good and stages that have been bad. I look at the military phase of the operation going in until the fall of the statue of Saddam as being an absolutely phenomenal and well-planned and well-conducted enterprise. The handoff phases since then, it seems like to me, have been real fits and starts. And there have been real problems that have taken place along the way. But we've continued to move down this course of trying to help a society transition to an open one. I think you're seeing that plan continue to unfurl, and it is difficult, and it is difficult to plan in minute detail. There are planning stages. They've been implemented to date. They're under an interim constitution that the Iraqi Governing Council has put together. They're developing Iraqi troops and police force. That's taking place. Some have shown themselves well. Many times they have not. And then, you know, you're getting an internationally selected leadership that will be an interim government until you can have full elections. This has been by fits and starts. I wouldn't disagree with you at all. But I don't think you can discount everything and say the whole thing has been bad. It's just this is very, very difficult in a tough region of the world.
Steve, thanks for the call. And Senator Brownback, thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Take care.
Thank you. Sam Brownback, a Republican from Kansas. He spoke with us on the phone from Los Angeles. When we come back from a short break, the U.S. and Britain, as we mentioned, have proposed a draft resolution to deal with the future in Iraq. We'll talk about what the resolution says and how it might be received at the United Nations. Our number, 800-989-8255, or you can send us email, TOTN@NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Yesterday, the United States and Britain sent a draft resolution on Iraq to the UN Security Council. The resolution is designed to garner international support for the mission in Iraq, legitimize both the interim government that will take office after June 30th and the presence of U.S.-led forces. But several questions still remain, not the least of which is how much sovereignty will actually be transferred to the interim government. If you have questions about the new resolution and what it'll mean for the future of Iraq, our number, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now is Philip Gordon, a foreign policy expert at the Brookings Institution, the author of Allies at War, America, Europe, and the Crisis Over Iraq. He served as Director for European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. He's with us from his office here in Washington. Good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Nice to be here.
Also with us, Stephen Everts, Director of the Transatlantic Program at the Center for European Reform. He's with us on the line from his office in London. Welcome.
Pleased to be with you.
The main points of the resolution, transfer of power by June 30th, ensuring that elections will go ahead next January, giving Iraqis control over oil revenues, though with some supervision, and giving the interim government responsibility and authority to govern a sovereign Iraq. What's the reaction to those terms on this side of the Atlantic, Philip Gordon?
Well, there's not a lot of surprise over here. I mean, it's pretty much like the president's speech last night. These are ideas that we've been talking about for months, really. The idea is to move beyond the occupation and create the notion that now Iraqis are taking over their own sovereignty. So this is what the president has been talking about, the administration has been talking about for months, and it finally codifies it, and there's quite a good chance that the UN Security Council will approve it. The problem, as you identified, Neil, in your opening remarks, is the enduring ambiguity of some of these ideas. We have been, you know, the government has been trying with great difficulty to explain what it means by full sovereignty, and they talked about full sovereignty and limited sovereignty, and really trying to figure out what authority the new Iraqi government would have, for example, over U.S. troops and over oil revenues. And if you look at this resolution carefully, I'm not sure that we've actually figured out the degree to which they are really in control or the degree to which we remain in control.
Stephen Everts, we've heard some reaction from European diplomats, particularly at the UN, saying a positive step, a way forward, but needs work. Is that issue of sovereignty what they mean when they say it needs work?
I think I agree with that. Yeah, the baseline reaction is very positive, constructive. I mean, nobody's talking about vetoes. That's the 2003 agenda, if you like. So people are looking at it very seriously and see if some further clarifications of some of these ambiguities that Phil Gordon mentioned can be agreed upon. And I think it's sort of noteworthy in that respect that Tony Blair today said that in his view, what he sort of had in mind with respect to full sovereignty would, for instance, be a veto right by the new Iraqi government on some sensitive military operations. So, you know, coalition troops would remain under coalition command, but we would give a say to the new Iraqi government on some military operations. Now, it'd be sort of interesting to see whether that's also the interpretation in Washington. And secondly, some of the things that other Europeans are pointing out, the French and Germans notably, is whether there should be some sort of assessment date, not this full year renewal of the multinational force, but maybe to have a sort of a 6-month review built into the resolution on top of what is already there, some reference to what the Iraqi government can request.
Just to clarify, the draft resolution proposes that U.S.-led forces stay in Iraq and that their circumstances be reviewed after a year, and you were suggesting maybe 6 months. An email question from Richard Averett in New York. Please ask how America hopes to attract foreign troops, to replace battle-weary Americans. What can we offer other nations in return for their sacrifice? Stephen Everts, do you think that this resolution, if it passes in something close to the form in which it is now, that other nations are going to be willing to send troops to help out in Iraq?
I think sending the expectation that other countries will send troops is probably optimistic, if not misplaced. I think, you know, France and Germany, under present circumstances, have made their position very clear. They opposed the war from the beginning. They, you know, say that to some extent that war is still going on, even if at a lower level of violence. Nonetheless, the situation is very dramatic. So troops is not a real issue. Other forms of international support should be doable. financial expertise with reconstruction, et cetera, et cetera. It's very notable, for instance, that the European Union, which has some expertise in helping post-conflict situations forward, is not using that expertise. The EU spends a derisory 200 million euros at the moment in Iraq, and surely that's a figure that can improve. So don't ask for troops, because they're not going to come, but ask for financial and other forms of resources.
Philip Gordon, you were recently in Europe, and you say you've noticed a certain amount of anger now that the U.S. is asking the international community for support. What were people telling you?
Oh, well, I mean, I think Stephen has it right when he says, you know, don't expect troops. If anyone thinks that the UN resolution, to which the Europeans are responding quite favorably, will lead to troops, they are misguided. I mean, the fact is the Europeans are quite angry. They've detected a pattern here in our own foreign policy, and especially on Iraq, where they were against it. Instead of recognizing their sort of legitimate right as democratic allies to disagree with what we wanted to do, we berated them, accused them of following commercial interests, and so on and so forth. And then when things got, and our assumption was that we didn't really need them. We would go in, we would win the war, we would find weapons of mass destruction, we would show links between Saddam and Al-Qaeda, and then we'd quickly stabilize the place, and they would be coming back to us to see if they could get involved. Obviously, it hasn't worked out that way, and so you do. It's not surprising that you get a bit of irritation in Europe now as things get very difficult when we turn and say, well, can you guys help us get out of this one, and then sort of get angry at them when they're unwilling to do so. So that was the mood, and that's why, again, I can only confirm what Stephen was saying, which is that I think this can be a start towards getting international support. We're starting from a very low point. We transfer sovereignty. We get the UN involved. Both of those things, by the way, are what the Europeans have been for some time asking us to do. And then if we can start to get a handle on the security situation and move forward, in the longer run, I don't exclude European support, even perhaps troops. In the short run, this is our problem and our issue to deal with.
Let's get some callers involved in the conversation. Brian joins us on the phone from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have a quick question that just about the fairness of your guests. Well, they may think that how fair is it of the United States to ask for help kind of now, you know, kind of in a time when people have been opposed to what we're doing, to now go to the UN kind of hat in hand and ask for help? And also, if indeed we get the help, what kind of political capital will we have to spend to do that?
Stephen Everts.
Well, I think the broad thrust of the question is the right one. Basically, the Europeans have been saying for some time that they'll only be willing to make contributions if there's a real sharing of political decision-making in a UN context and in another context. And people remain to be convinced of that. On paper, things look good, but I've also heard it said today that, you know, finally the United States is pursuing the right policy, but is doing so at the wrong time. And that came from a relatively senior figure in the British government. So I think you'll have to bear that in mind as, you know, other Europeans look at the supposedly new American strategy unfolding. They say, well, are the Americans for real? Are they really going to share power with Europeans and others in Iraq, but also perhaps in other areas? And I know that Phil Gordon has written about this. This could be a test case. The Americans have a real difficulty at their hands, want international support. Are they willing to cede power and influence to get that?
What kind of power and influence? We'll get to you in a minute, Philip, but what kind of power and influence are you talking about, Stephen?
Well, it comes to, you know, what kind of government will be formed. You know, is it really Brahimi who calls the shot, or is it, you know, behind the scenes, is it a heavy hand of American influence? But more broadly, I think in the Middle East, you know, there are grave reservations in Europe, as is well known, with respect to other aspects of U.S. policy, for instance, on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, on Iran, on some of the other issues. I think that, you know, a lot of Europeans, and I would share that, would, you know, strongly welcome a more coordinated and united American-European strategy towards these issues. But very often we see an America that says, here's the plan, who's willing to support us? But the plan can be changed. You know, consultation for many people in the Bush administration is about explaining your policy, not about forging together a united strategy.
Philip, you were trying to get in, I think?
Yeah, I was just going to add to that. I mean, I understand why Europeans are not exactly anxious to send forces into Iraq now for the reasons we've been saying. They thought it was a bad idea in the first place. And then for us to to come to them when they're in a difficult situation. Ask their leaders. I mean, think about it. The violence in Iraq, a democratic leader in Europe is supposed to go to their people and say, you were against this war, I was against this war. The Americans haven't exactly treated us well, but what the heck, you know, why don't we send some troops to take risks in Iraq? That's not going to happen. What I think the Europeans do need to do, however, is tell us under what conditions they would be willing to help. Fair enough, they don't want to help under the conditions that we have that have brought us to where we are now. But are there any conditions under which they would help? And there you actually wonder what the answer is. I mean, we have started to, we are about to transfer sovereignty to an Iraqi government. That's what they wanted. We've got the UN involved to a most ironic degree with the Bush administration turning over all of the politics to the UN. Does that help? As Stephen said, I think it's right. You know, I think 6 or 9 months ago, that might have been enough to get more European help. It's not now and we're too late. But under what conditions would Europeans actually help? If the answer is none, then we need to know that, and again, it's back to an American problem. The other thing I would just say quickly is that Europeans also need to understand their own interest in this affair and the consequences of an American failure for them, which also might lead them to reflect on whether they might not want to help a little bit more. If we get driven out of Iraq, the message sent to terrorists around the world would be that with enough, you know, car bombings, suicide bombings, and beheadings of civilians, you can change a Western government's policy. That message would be horrible for Europe, as would an Iraq that turned into a failed state and haven for terrorists like the old Afghanistan. So I think Europeans, if they reflect on their own interest in a stable Iraq, should be able to come to us and tell us under what conditions they would help, and we should think seriously about meeting those conditions.
Brian, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Here's an email question. Last night, the president said elections in Iraq no later than January of 2005. Larry asks, does it make sense to hold elections in the fall rather than January, possibly only in the more stable areas? Is there any fudge room on that, and is that significant? Stephen Everts?
I think that there's not sort of a great deal of opposition on this side of the Atlantic to the plans to have elections in say, January. One can hope that by that time the security situation will have improved if we get a more positive political dynamic, and that's something that Senator Levin was speaking about earlier, and I fully endorse that. Something that I think a lot of Europeans would add to that. It's not just a question of organizing elections, welcome and central though that is. It's also about, you know, creating a broader political process of, you know, writing a permanent constitution, making sure that you get all the other pieces of a more pluralistic, inclusive political system going with, you know, a functioning judiciary, a real independent media, et cetera, et cetera. You need progress on that as well. I think all of us, Americans and Europeans, in this kind of situations, whether it's in the Balkans or in Afghanistan or in Iraq, focus a bit too much on elections and when they're held, and perhaps not enough on this sort of flanking policies that we also need if we want to be successful in the medium to longer term.
Stephen Everts, director of the Transatlantic Program at the Center for European Reform. We're also speaking with Philip Gordon, a foreign policy expert at the Brookings Institution. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Of course, there is one European nation that has been extremely helpful to the United States in all of this, and that is Britain. And thus far, Tony Blair, the Prime Minister, has been uncritical of American policy. Over the weekend, a memo from the British Foreign Ministry was leaked to the media, which put some chinks in that complete armor. We should not underestimate the present difficulties, the document states. It's called Iraq in the Medium Term. It suggests that heavy-handed U.S. military tactics in Fallujah and Najaf some weeks ago have fueled both Sunni and Shiite opposition to the coalition and lost us much public support inside Iraq, and the scandal over Abu Ghraib has damaged the moral authority of Britain and the United States. Is there space widening between the British government of Tony Blair and the government of George W. Bush in Washington, Stephen Everts?
Well, I think what that memo sort of reflects is three things. One is there has from the word go has been considerable unease in sort of senior political and also military circles in the UK about US military tactics. And this is something that's been rumbling on from basically last summer, and that's obviously reached a crescendo with the rising insurgency in March and April. And this is something that senior military figures in the UK feel quite strongly about. They, you know, the argument being that the US doesn't know quite how to handle counterinsurgency. Well, we, the Brits, with our experience in Northern Ireland and in other places, are better at this kind of thing. That's one thing. Second thing is that the Foreign Office, as an institution, not the political leadership, the Foreign Secretary, etc., but the Foreign Office as an institution, has always had great reservations about this war. And I think people at the Foreign Office who leaked this may have been sort of representing that segment of the British political scene. And thirdly, I think what we're seeing, and that likewise is reaching a crescendo, is sort of political pressure on Tony Blair from the Labour Party and other sections here to distance himself from George Bush. Now, Blair has made his position very clear. He's not going to do it. But if other people start to leak this kind of memos, it may suggest that, you know, they want to add to that kind of pressure.
Let's see if we can squeeze in one more call. Bruce is with us from Memphis, Tennessee.
Hi, Neil. How are you?
Very well.
Here's my question. Even if the United States made a mistake that Iraq was a threat, if it's generally agreed that the Iraqi people, for the most part, would like a free society, would like to be able to send their children to school and educate them and have a representative government, and if that's what the U.S. is fighting for, what is the hesitation on the part of Europeans or anyone else who cares about a free and democratic society? I wonder what their interest actually is in the thing. Is it a political, economic thing? But if we're fighting for a free Iraq, even if we made a mistake, why are they holding back now? Shouldn't they be supporting the fight now for a free and democratic Iraq?
Well, Stephen Everts, you're there in Europe.
Yeah, no, a very fair question, and I think you're right. I think if you look at what the European interests are and what the overall political position is, then it's exactly what you just said. Our interests and our desires and preferences are, like you said, are for a free Iraq that is has a pluralistic political system and that can shape its own future. I think the reservation that people have are sort of twofold. One is a political point, and it's something that Phil Gordon mentioned earlier, which is that a lot of European leaders got berated, got insulted, frankly, in the American press and elsewhere for being cheese-eating surrender monkeys. And obviously, it's there's a lot of hurt, and that is something that we need to take into account. The second point,
and if it could be very quick.
So is that Europeans feel that the difficulties that the coalition has in Iraq today are because it's dominated by the United States. So they don't want to shore up an operation which should be in their interest, but one operation that they feel is failing because it's dominated by the United States. So
Stephen Everts and Philip Gordon, thanks to you both. We'll be back after a break. It's Talk of the Nation, NPR News.